Welcome I've been contemplating the relationship of the recognition of how we depend on each other and gratitude and kindness and compassion and these all seem to go together. We often think that we are independent beings, even if we've heard otherwise. Don't we think so? Don't we feel as if we have control over our life? Especially, I think, in the modern American world, we can go home and open the refrigerator and there's food in there. And it's like, of course. It's not so much like, wow, this is amazing that all this life is supporting me and that I can eat another meal and live another day. We just take it for granted because, like, well, we got that food and we got that refrigerator. We're in control of this situation. We set up our life to work out. And sometimes it doesn't quite exactly the way we plan. And we often then get upset. And I think the more we feel as if we're independent and in control, the more upset we are when things don't go according to plan. If we were to actually, I think again, in our modern culture and affluence, it gives this false sense of independence. So I think someone who's really, really poor and just living day to day on whatever food is given them as they're begging for their next meal, they maybe don't have the expectation that things will be going really well. So maybe they might complain less. I don't know. You know, it depends on the situation, right? But it seems ironic that we have so much and we often complain when things don't go quite right. An example of this, so this is the connection to gratitude. I think when we're aware of our sense of dependence on others, we naturally feel grateful when a little bit of food comes or something, or we have a place to sleep tonight. Whereas if we feel like we set that all up, we're in control, we maybe don't feel such gratitude for it. Again, I think not always, but it can go this way. Like an example might be, many of you have done Zen sesshins where we sit for the week, and it's part of the setup of sesshin is it's kind of like giving up control and just depending on the schedule that's given to us and the forms and guidelines that are given. So I often find going into those weeks I get a little, my sense of self gets a little shaky the days before, almost every time, because I feel like, oh, this is like a week where I'm not in control anymore. I'm giving up my sense of independence and we're going to together create this difficult thing. Very simple, but I think difficult partly for that reason. but I would like the bell to ring now instead of like a little bit later. No, we're going to give that up. And even the Doan who's in charge of ringing the bell might be like, I'd like to ring it now too. But there's the schedule in front of me. I guess we just go with that. And then we have these meals we eat in the Zendo. And we put out our bowls and food comes to us. And it's probably almost never exactly what we would choose if we were cooking ourselves. Sometimes it's quite good often, but you know, we're not in control of what comes to us. And yet, especially as the days of Sesshin go by, I think maybe those of you who have sat these retreats know this experience of you can be so grateful for just whatever this food is that comes. I think partly because we're not in control and we realize that we're dependent. We can't even go and get the food. We have to wait till it's brought to us. And this sense of total dependence on others creates a natural sense of gratitude. Whereas then another scenario is we go to a restaurant. We're in control. Can I see the menu? Actually, I don't know about things on this menu. Do you have anything else? Because I'm in control here. I'm going to pay you. So we feel this sense of independence. And then we order something and maybe we order white rice, nice and easy to chew. But they bring us brown rice. In Sesshin, we maybe don't even know what kind of rice is coming, and maybe we're not always grateful, right? But rice, we have something to eat to break up the monotony of all this zazen. But in the restaurant, the brown rice comes, and I ordered white, can you please take it back? Or we're disappointed. We had an expectation that we were in control, so now we're disappointed. So this kind of thing. It's just an illusion that we're ever independent, but when we have that, we start believing that we are, then we're easily disappointed and easily not so grateful, seems to me. So we have this teaching of everything is dependent on everything else. So what a wonderful practice to try to remember that, you know, explore that. See if it seems true in all different situations and remember again and again. And the more we remember, the more it goes along with this feeling of gratitude. They seem related. And gratitude is just a wonderfully beautiful, happy feeling. I've even heard some teachers say something like, gratitude is actually enlightenment. They're like the same thing. And maybe that's going a little bit far, but if it's not the same thing, it's maybe closely related. Enlightenment, you know, the end of suffering, complete peace and ease is like that feeling of gratitude, right? Gratitude is like, nothing's lacking, I'm just happy to whatever's happening. I'm content. So it kind of is maybe like enlightenment. Maybe if you said gratitude, you know, no matter what's happening, not just when things are going according to our expectations, but gratitude for everything. I think that's how a Buddha lives in the world. They're just grateful for whatever happens, pleasant or unpleasant. So, by realizing our dependence on others, we may realize enlightenment, called gratitude. And then along with gratitude, especially for others, for other living beings, for other people, then naturally from that seems to arise a sense of wanting to like repay their kindness. Not so much like it's some debt that we owe them and, oh, they were kind to us, so I guess we should be kind back to keep things even. Not like that, but like natural arising. Like when somebody, we really feel happy, somebody's really kind to us, we naturally feel this loving kindness and wish for them to be happy. Not as kind of like a business deal, a kind of exchange, but I think we naturally feel that. And we naturally feel compassion, like we wish them to be free from suffering. Because we feel this connection. So our opening to the reality of interdependence, particularly dependence on other people and living beings, gives rise to gratitude, which gives rise to loving kindness, which gives rise to and is closely related to compassion. And not necessarily that it's like that linear, it's maybe these all go together. So if we're feeling grateful, we're probably feeling some sense of interdependence. Maybe these are things we could check out. And a moment of gratitude, do we feel like I am totally in control of things here? Maybe. We might feel grateful that we're finally got in control. But I think often moments of true gratitude are like, wow, everything is coming together to create the situation. And we're not so in control, but we feel grateful. And a moment of feeling kindness or compassion, see if we also feel gratitude towards that person and see if we also feel some interdependent relationship with them. They just all go together. And they're all wonderful Dharma qualities, remembering our dependence and lack of independence, gratitude and kindness and compassion. And a little practice that I like to do is, like in Zen we have a meal chant that goes with these meals in the Zendo. And I like to chant it just by myself at home whenever I eat something. It begins with this line, innumerable labors brought us this food. We should know how it comes to us. Let us reflect on how it comes to us. So if I stop and remember particularly that first line, kind of looking at the food, it changes the experience of eating, actually. I feel, wow, it's the same old thing, maybe, same old meal. But it's kind of miraculous that this is possible. That so many people and energies of the earth and the whole universe have come together to bring us this meal. It just creates. It's that particular reflection, I think, is to arouse gratitude, and often works. If we slow down enough to actually listen to what we're saying, that's a little bit hard. So a sense of self-sufficiency often leads to complaint or feeling like a lack. Kind of interesting, kind of counterintuitive, I think. That's why I bring it up. So being offering kindness to others because we're to repay their kindness, it's not so much like that means we should do whatever they say. So even like our mother, who is often brought up as the example of someone who is really kind to us, even if we had a hard time with our mother, she, you know, in our earliest years, she basically kept us alive. She fed us and clothed us and took care like that. So our very life depended on her in a very direct way. So people naturally feel this sense of gratitude towards their mothers. Not always. maybe grandmothers sometimes. But people who've greatly supported us, kind benefactors, we feel this sense of gratitude. But then to repay that or to offer our kindness back doesn't necessarily mean, well, then my mother thinks that, I don't know, I shouldn't live at a Zen center or something like that, because that's crazy. Then, oh, well, I should just, to be kind to her, then I shouldn't. I think it's not, I don't think it's like this. I think it's not necessarily that, because what they want may be misguided. All sentient beings are somewhat confused. So it's not necessarily that we give people exactly what they want, especially if it feels like it's not the right thing for us to do. But we're just willing, we're ready to listen to them, we're ready to help. It's this readiness. And what we really wish for them, when we wish may all beings be happy, from the Dharma point of view, happiness is not so much like she thinks she's got me under control, that my mom is happy because I'm doing what she wants. That's not really the kind of happiness we want to offer mom. We really want to offer her the happiness of her own loving kindness and compassion and joy and equanimity. That's like her happiness that comes from not so much superficial things that she thinks she wants. So sometimes we give people some superficial things that they seem to want. But not if it's doesn't seem so helpful to the bigger picture. So this is a year of exploring loving kindness and compassion, and we've talked about loving kindness already some. Loving kindness is kind of the antidote or the opposite of what? This little what?
Anger.
Anger. It's kind of like when the mind is infused with loving kindness, there cannot be anger at the same time. This is another interesting thing to check out. Like you can't have them both. So it's kind of we remember loving kindness. So it's a natural quality, but we can also cultivate it as to kind of like let go of an angry mind. And then we have these are like in the traditional teachings. That's the kind of opposite. And then there's we might call a quality that's similar to loving kindness, but actually opposite or quite different. Or it's an obstacle or blockage to loving kindness, even though it looks similar. Sometimes they're called near enemies of these qualities. Does anybody know what that one is for loving kindness? It looks similar to loving kindness, but it actually isn't really opening the heart in the same way as loving kindness.
Pity?
I think pity goes with the next one, compassion.
Attachment.
Yeah, I think attachment, or like loving kindness with like attached love.
With strings attached.
With strings attached, yeah, like love with an agenda. Or with a kind of personal, I'll love this person if they love me back. So it looks very close. Maybe at first it looks identical, but then I think these strings attached are what keep it from being true loving kindness, which is just the pure wish that others be happy unconditionally, even if they're mean to me. So that's why we kind of work up towards loving kindness towards people that we actually maybe don't bring us so much happiness, that are kind of difficult, that make us angry, that annoy us. That's the hardest, right? We work up to that. Wishing. It's an internal with a lot of these practices of Buddha Dharma. We enact it. We can enact it physically because that helps the internal mindset, but they're like internal trainings which make a difference in our life, in the world. We start inside looking at, studying how the mind. So then we have, that's Maitri or Metta in Pali. And then we have Karuna is compassion, which is if loving kindness is the wish, may all beings be happy. Anyone remember what the kind of classic definition of compassion? Yeah, may all beings be free from suffering. Very similar, but one's like the kind of positive happiness and one's like may they be free from this. So loving kindness is naturally a kind of more happy feeling for ourselves. It's just, there's nothing but happiness we're thinking about here. Compassion is a little bit like people are suffering or someone's suffering and we wish them to be free and we kind of feel their suffering. So it's a little bit like, it's not quite as exuberant a feeling, but it's a very, they're equally open-hearted. Maybe compassion's a little bit harder just because of that reason. It's a little bit painful to really feel others suffering. But they go together. And, freedom from suffering is, again, from a, when we see more deeply what causes suffering, it's not so much that, the baby's crying because they can't watch their favorite TV show and that kind of, that's not so much the compassion. We feel sad for them because of that, because they're suffering because they're angry, they've lost their natural sense of loving kindness and compassion and joy and equanimity. But the example of the baby can't watch the TV show, that would be one example of this similar but different quality. So pity is one. Pity is like condescending, a condescending kind of like looking down, oh, you poor thing, kind of like, it's a kind of removing ourselves from someone down there. So it's not quite, compassion is we're really meeting them, we're really feeling, joining them in their suffering. Pity is a little separating and a little bit like proud and looking down. But it's close. It feels, it's kind of similar, so it's one of those things to watch out for. But another one that's kind of unrelated, these are all listed in different kind of classic lists here, is this one like the baby, oh, I feel so sad for you that you can't watch your TV show. It's kind of like the sadness at a kind of like, at someone else, or, resonating with someone else's sadness about some really like worldly, mundane thing that they can't have. So we might say, well, maybe that's a gray area. As like if somebody's starving and they need some food and they're really suffering because of that, that's not exactly like a worldly, mundane thing. It's like, it's a basic need. So it's, I don't know if we can draw a black and white line here, but whining about some ridiculous thing that's probably not even good for them and feeling like, oh, just because we love them, we feel, I really wish that you, I'm so sorry that you can't have this, I really feel your pain. It's like, maybe with kids it's a little bit easier because, we just want them to, they haven't developed the other kind of values necessarily. So it's a little tricky one, but maybe that's something to think about. What is this, worldly or, worldly comforts that people are lacking? I think that was listed in the Visuddhimagga, the Theravada meditation manual. So maybe it has a little bit like austere flavor to that text. But it's similar to the one about like the attached love. It's like a kind of worldly love. This would be kind of like a worldly compassion about a worldly suffering. And if the opposite, or you know, if loving kindness is the antidote for its opposite, which is anger or annoyance, or hatred, what do you think karuna is the antidote or opposite towards? The, like kind of extreme opposite.
Indifference.
I think I've sometimes heard it that way, and I think I would have said that. So I was surprised to see this in a couple of the classical texts. It's similar to hatred, but cruelty. And I think it's because it's like wanting others to be free from suffering is the opposite of actually causing them suffering, which is cruelty. Or, you know, vihimsa. So ahimsa is like non-violence, non-cruelty. So that compassion is like not only do we wish them, you know, an extreme opposite of wishing others to be free is actually like intentionally causing them harm through our cruelty. It's a little different than anger, close to anger, but anger is just more like the emotion that's different from loving kindness, but cruelty is causing the suffering. So, yeah, apathy or, you know, not caring, I think I would say, that's what I would have said, actually, too, is, so that's maybe something in between the extreme opposite and this very near opposite. With compassion, we're trying to develop a loving concern and wishing others to be free. And often, when we're not doing that, it's not exactly that we're being cruel, but we just don't care so much. Especially if the people aren't so related to us. This is one where I think it's quite difficult as a kind of mind training to, not so difficult with those we really love and are close to, but even for strangers, maybe on the news or something, maybe we feel a little bit of this feeling for people we don't know. Oh, that's really painful. But not so much, especially like massive painful situations like genocide or a drought where everyone's dying. It's almost like it's too much to really feel each individual's suffering. So compassion. So here's some inspirational verses about compassion. This is the beginning of Chandrakirti's introduction to the Middle Way. He's a 7th century Indian Middle Way writer. So he gets into all kinds of Madhyamaka philosophy, but he kind of frames the whole thing in this context of compassion. So he starts this long treatise. Buddhas take their birth from bodhisattvas. Buddhas, the great beings that are completely free from suffering and live for the benefit of all beings, they're born from bodhisattvas. Heard this before, probably. Bodhisattvas have the vow to realize Buddha. Compassion, non-duality, and the wish for Buddhahood for others' sake are the causes of the children of the Buddha. Bodhisattvas are the children of the Buddha. So the causes of bodhisattvas, what what makes a bodhisattva, in this case, is these three things. Compassion comes first. Non-duality, maybe we would say realizing non-duality, and the wish to realize Buddhahood for the benefit of others. These three are the cause for bodhisattvas. Of Buddhahood's abundant crop, compassion is the seed. It's also like moisture bringing increase, and it's said to ripen in the state of lasting happiness. Therefore, to begin, I celebrate compassion. So, compassion is like the seed to make a Buddha, and then it's also the water, in this case it's the moisture that makes the seed grow, and the seed ripens into this plant called lasting happiness. Therefore, to begin, I celebrate compassion, which is the first seed. Beings think I at first and cling to self. They think of mine and are attached to things. Thus, they turn helplessly as buckets on a water wheel, and to compassion for such beings I bow down. So, I bow to this great compassion for beings that think I... This is a nice little summary of the teaching here, too. Beings, first, they think I'm here. And they attach to a view of an independent self. And then based on this I, they think mine. You can't really have, you know, this is my book. There's no mine until first we have I, and then based on I, immediately, everything is mine. Yeah, everything's mine. Even though, you know, in a way, it's like self and others. As soon as there's a self, there's others. And the others are mine, not necessarily in the sense that I own it, like, I paid for this book, so it's mine. But also, like, even like this Zendo, it's my Zendo. And it's actually, Santa Cruz is my town. It's not that I own it, but it's my town, right? It's related to me. California is my state. The U.S. is my country. This planet is my home. This is my universe. So everything is mine as soon as there's an I. And some little subset of that we may feel even more is like, I actually own it. I don't think mine necessarily means we own, but we feel like it's my world. It's everybody else's too, but I feel like when I relate to it, I relate to it as my world. So beings think I at first, and they cling to this illusion that there's somebody in control of this uncontrollable, interdependent life. Then they think automatically mine, and they cling to things. Thus they turn helplessly as buckets on a water wheel. So one image is us. We are like these buckets on a water wheel, and like the waters, like maybe our karma is just pouring forward, driven by our illusion of I and mine. It's spinning us around and around. And one commentary says, it's actually the buckets, there's 12 buckets, like the 12-fold chain, this cycle going around and around, being spun by the water of karma. But another translation, we don't know what ancient Indian water systems were like, I don't know anyway, whether they actually had water wheels, but another... I've seen it actually translated as a well, a bucket in a well. So sentient beings are like these helpless buckets on a well, and that has the sense of also like they're being pulled up and down by these forces in which they're not in control. their own karma, maybe. But it feels like, I don't want to go down into this dark, damp, cold well. I want to go up there into the sunlight, but I'm going down, down, down. And I'm not in control here. How painful. And as we go up and down, banging against the sides of the well, bruised over and over in the dark against this stone well, a nice image to think about, us sentient beings, getting pulled up and down through samsara, bouncing around, and this is an image to arouse compassion. We're so helpless in this well. So for all these helpless beings moving upward and downward through the six realms of samsara, driven by, you know, blindly by karmic tendencies, which we don't even notice, it's so painful. So when we think about this, compassion, the wish, may these buckets of water be free from this predicament. So that's these three types of compassion here. This is the first type. Compassion for these actual people the way we normally see them, like buckets in a well. The next verse is, beings are like the moon in rippling water, fitful, fleeting, empty in their nature. Bodhisattvas see them thus and yearn to set them free. Their wisdom is beneath compassion's power. So one way to arouse compassion is the basic way that we can always deal with when we start to remember this is so, this predicament of this life where all kinds of things happen and it's so confusing to be a person in this world. We get knocked around a lot. It's very easy to arouse compassion for. And then, because he's going to write this whole treatise about emptiness, he's saying, let's unite these now. This is compassion for empty beings like the moon in rippling water. So we'll picture the reflection of the moon on a lake, and there it is with the clear moon, but then a wind comes up and the water starts rippling, and it changes. The reflection just changes as soon as the ripples come. So these beings are, all of us beings are actually like these reflections on the water, and we're changing all the time according to the wind. So we're impermanent, and we're empty of these of any substantial true existence. So this is a commentary on this by Jeffrey Hopkins in a book on compassion. He says, talking about this image of the moon in the water, which in Zen, this is that we have this image too. In the Genjo Koan, Dogen brings up enlightenment. It's like the moon reflected in the water. The enlightenment he's talking about is, in this case, an image. It's not some, enlightenment is not some graspable thing. It's just like a reflection of the moon on water. Now here we're talking about sentient beings. People are like the moon reflected on the water. A reflection of the moon in water appears to be a moon, but it's not. Sentient beings appear to exist inherently in and of themselves, but they really don't exist the way that they think they do. When you get used to looking at the moon and water, seeing from every side that it's not a moon, although it appears to be, especially if the lake's very still, you can look very, it looks, or a mirror, even more so. It really looks exactly like the image. But it's not. You look at your face in the mirror, it really looks like you. But it's not. It's an appearance. So, see, you look at this moon from every side, so you see that it's not a moon, although it appears to be. And you get used to that, then when you look at a sentient being, you can use this as an introduction to the fact that although you experience a person that seems to exist from their own side, like in and of themselves, it's not really the case. The face in the mirror appears to be a face, but it's not a face from any point of view. Similarly, an inherently existent person existing right here with mind and body in and of itself doesn't really exist. But such an inherently existent person really does appear to exist. Don't we? Emptiness doesn't mean there are no people and that therefore you don't need to be compassionate. That's not what it means. No! Exclamation point. That's silly. Emptiness means people don't exist in the concrete way we imagine them to. Myself, yourself. We don't exist so solidly. For example, a table appears to cover the area of its bases of designation. It's a little bit technical. In other words, the collection of the top of the table, the legs, and so forth. The table, this stand here, this book stand appears to cover the top and the legs of the table. The table appears to cover these parts. But no such table exists here, actually, right? It's funny language, but I appreciate this kind of language. There's a table that appears to be like kind of overlaid on its parts or that covers its parts. It's a funny way of talking, but you can kind of, when you look at it, doesn't it seem kind of like that? Okay, there's not really like a tableness of table here, but there seems to be some tableness. Like, this is a table, right? But actually, it's just a designation that works quite well. Although, maybe not always, because some people might say, that's a book stand, it's actually not a table. So therefore, that kind of proves that it's not, there's no real tableness to it. But we think, and we, even more so when we see a sentient being, like I see Neti, and I think, it's not just like like some Netiness overlaid on five skandhas. I see Neti! And like some concrete, like actual being, very familiar. Maybe because sentient beings are so familiar, we believe they're who they are. So the table appears to cover the area of its bases of designation, or it appears to cover the collection of the top, the legs, and so forth, but no such actual table exists there. Still, this does not mean that there's no table at all. We have to determine what the example is exemplifying. The illusory appearance of inherent existence, which is like tableness, like an essence of actual table. This is not a doctrine of non-existence in general, but a doctrine of the non-existence of a certain type of false, over-concretized existence. It does not deny all existence. Realization of impermanence helps towards realizing that persons and other things are empty of such concreteness, but the realization of emptiness is more subtle than impermanence. It has to do with how we conceptualize things. The Dalai Lama advises that we do this type of meditation with a person or other phenomena that we value highly. since the experience of emptiness will not be misinterpreted as devaluing of the subject. The value will remain high, but seen in a different way. That's kind of nice, isn't it? So if you take something that you don't really care about, you might start to get nihilistic about it. Well, there really is no table here, actually. So, like, it doesn't matter. Like, whatever. You just throw it out the window. It's like, who cares? Which is, there's something kind of nice. We're getting less attached to this my table. And actually even me. But if we value, if it's like a loved one and we start to empty them, we start to deconstruct them from our conceptual overlays, then we don't devalue them. We don't say, well, throw my loved one out the window. So that's kind of nice, a nice antidote to really getting into this deconstructing project of emptiness, to not start devaluing things. So the Dalai Lama, the great bodhisattva of the modern world, who likes to do these kinds of meditations, says it's kind of nice to do it with something that you highly value, so that the experience of emptiness will not be misinterpreted as devaluing the subject that's empty. Yes.
What is it then that is valued? Like, I'm thinking of this practice, right? And I'm thinking, like, for example, with you, I mean, say, Rev or Shoko, or your parents, right? All people that I know, you really care for, like, all people that I care for. So, you know, we want to recognize that we don't want to over-concretize. We don't want to think we know who they are. So maybe one would, you might do this practice. But then he says...
Yeah, good question.
...want to devalue. So what then are you valuing?
Yeah, what are we valuing?
You're valuing relationship.
Valuing relationship. Yeah, which is this the ungraspable, interdependent way wow, I actually start to see Rosie's really not who I think she is, but actually there's something happening here, but you don't know what it is. Mr. Jones. something.
All the time, you know?
What's that?
Changing all the time.
Changing all the time and impermanent.
Surprise
and appearing. Every so often we say we don't devalue appearances, even if the whole world is like a dream of appearances, when we really start to see it, it's nothing is what we think it is, and yet we like value this dream. Now, it's just a dream, so it doesn't matter. And we're really going to live wholeheartedly in this dream, and this dream of the dream is relationships, and like a rainbow. Maybe we probably value a rainbow so much because it is not so substantial. It's beautiful because we can't get a hold of it. Yeah. So, and I think this is the connection now to that emptiness does not undermine compassion, but they actually go quite nicely together. So I think these are some answers to Kathy's important question, but I still feel like our answers maybe don't completely do it justice. I think it's really hard to say, actually, what is it that we actually value? Because what is it? What is all this appearance anyway? and why do we value it? I think that's this almost like the koan of the bodhisattva, who sees, I vow to bring all these beings born in all these ways to complete nirvana, free from all suffering, and yet I really see there really aren't any beings. It's like, seems like total contradiction, and to even explain it in any way, maybe doesn't even do it total justice. And yet, this is our life. He goes on a little bit more. This is a little kind of like instructions to my practice with this. Jeffrey Hopkins says, first, get used to this experience of slowly looking over the image of the reflection of the moon. This is a profound, essential thing, going over every part of it. And this is a metaphor now, but we could do this with anything. Like the tableness of the table. So it's like the appearance of the table, the appearance of the moon, the appearance of our face in the mirror. Look over every piece of it. And he says, this is very important, realizing every part of it is not the moon. Like the crater here, that part's not the moon. The whole roundness is not the moon. The little like American flag over in the corner, that's not the moon. The whole thing is a reflection. The whole thing together is not a moon, that there's nothing there at all which is a moon. But it's, we don't deny that it's vividly appearing. Then, remaining in that experience of a vivid appearance of a moon, but the utter lack of a moon, view sentient beings or other things, and like a magician, understand that the object, however vividly it appears, does not exist inherently or essentially or independently in and of itself, even though it appears to exist in its own right. So we view sentient beings as their vivid appearance that they are, but the utter lack of sentient being at the same time. Understand that phenomena arise dependent on their causes and conditions, and arise dependent on their parts, such that they could not possibly exist in and of themselves as they seem to do. And particularly the classic thing for the person, for deconstructing the person in these old Indian systems, is you can use the dependent on causes and conditions, but most easiest to do is to look at how there's no person in addition to their parts. And the parts of a person are generally called the five aggregates. So the Heart Sutra is kind of about this. Eventually the false part of the appearance itself fades, leaving only the actual object for your mind's eye. How does such a perspective on the nature of appearances serve to generate compassion? If you see that sentient beings perceive themselves one way and yet exist another way, and thereby are drawn into suffering in order to satisfy this kind of self when there is no such self, no such self, in italics, not that there's no self, it's not the inherently existent self that we're trying to satisfy. If you see that at least certain desires and certain hatreds are predicated on this kind of self, and that people are leading themselves into trouble because of it, including ourselves, we naturally generate compassion for them if we have a sense of closeness with them, a sense of empathy. We realize how horrible it is that what people want and what they're engaged in are at cross purposes. Everyone wants happiness and doesn't want suffering, but is engaging in the causes of suffering which take them farther away from happiness. Isn't that moving? It's almost like when we see how this illusion of independent self causes so much suffering for ourselves and others, we naturally arouse compassion for these appearing, it's kind of an amazing thing, with these appearing, dependently arisen collections of five skandhas that are just these beautiful expressions of an inconceivable universe. And then they start thinking that they're like me and you. And then we're like, maybe there was a time and there were sentient beings that were just five skandhas, like just dancing and living and dying. And then somehow they started, oh wait, but this is like, there's like me here. And then there's like, samsara is born, and there's a world of suffering, and therefore we can have compassion for these strange beings we call humans and animals and other sentient beings. Well, it's a big topic. Lots more could be said, but it's time for tea. We dedicate any positive energy gathered from this meeting tonight to all sentient beings, like buckets moving up and down a well, or just like a rippling moon on the surface of a windy lake. May they be free from whatever binds them. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are bound.